What happened to Starship during Test Flight 7? Astronomers see a black hole's jets forming in real time. Curiosity finds ripples of an ancient shore and an insanely high-resolution image of Andromeda captured by Hubble. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. Last week, we saw the seventh test flight of Starship and Super Heavy, and the way our timing works for recording Space Bites, we actually held off our recording until the launch had completed, and then we did our report and talked about how the Super Heavy landed successfully, but Starship had failed. And now we've got a little bit more information about what happened. So there's a few details that we actually didn't notice when we were recording last week. The first thing is that when Starship and Super Heavy separated and Super Heavy was going to come back for its boost back burn, it was supposed to light 13 of its engines, but it only lit 12 of them. And then just as it was coming into the landing site, it actually relit all 13. And so whatever had happened when it started its boost back burn, it was able to successfully make its landing burn. And obviously it was caught successfully by Mechazilla. But then Starship continued on towards orbit and it lit 6 of its engines. Everything seemed fine. And then at about the 8.5 minute mark into the mission, they lost telemetry. They lost contact with the spacecraft and they knew that it was lost. Now, people on the ground actually saw the debris flying overhead from some of the Caribbean islands. So that's kind of amazing. And I'm sure you've seen a bunch of the video around here. I don't feel right displaying the videos without actually having negotiated the rights to be able to use them. I prefer to kind of work with stuff that we have available within the public domain or what that we have the rights to. So we'll put some links into the show notes where you can go and see what those images look like. They're pretty amazing. But according to SpaceX, they think that a fire started in the aft portion of the spacecraft and that led to a complete, what do they call it? A RUD? What's the RUD stand for? Rapid unscheduled disassembly. So it exploded. And they're still looking for the actual root cause, what actually caused that fire and the eventual explosion. And so when we find that out, we'll let you know. Black hole jets forming in real time. When supermassive black holes are actively feeding, the material chokes up and you get this accretion disk around the black hole. And then the rapidly rotating black hole, the magnetic fields form around this region, it interacts with the accretion disk, and you get these jets that appear coming out of the center of the black hole. And these jets can last for tens of thousands or millions of years. But now astronomers think they've found one of these jets forming in real time. So back in 2018, they were looking at a galaxy that's located about 270 million light years away. And they saw the X-ray corona at the center of the galaxy disappear. And then there was an outburst of radiation in a variety of wavelengths. And then astronomers saw these radio emissions and then the X-ray emissions of these jets starting to form at the center of the galaxy. And then you can actually see where the jets are moving away from the center of this galaxy. And so this is the first time that astronomers have actually seen these jets, which are like very familiar around a lot of other galaxies, actually see them start up. And they're not entirely sure what was the event that led to this. It could be just like the ingestion of one single star or a cloud of gas. And maybe that's all it takes. But it's a really great way to sort of understand the environment around these black holes, how they go from quiescent to more active. The Chinese are going to put a flapping flag on the moon. There is no wind on the moon, and so if you put a flag up on the moon, it's just going to hang. And of course, during the Apollo era, the astronauts knew that, and so they put up a flag on the moon for the US landing, and they had a rod at the top of the flag, and that held the flag out, and so you could actually see the American flag on the surface of the moon. But there's no wind, and so the flag is just going to hang still for as long as I guess it can survive the radiation environment being on the moon. But the Chinese have a plan to fix that. And actually, the idea came from elementary students that were wondering how you could have a flag flap on the surface of the moon. So the upcoming Chang'e 7 mission, which is going to be flying in 2026 is going to have a flag that it's going to erect on the surface of the moon. And the flag has wires that are coiled around inside the flag. And then it will be able to run electricity through these wires and then change them, which will create magnetic interactions between those wires. And then it can time where the electricity goes through the wires. And so it'll create this rippling effect of the flag on the surface of the moon. And I think this is great. Like when you think about some of the previous Chinese missions, they've made sure to put in selfie bots that are flying very close in formation with their spacecraft, or they'll deploy cameras out onto the surface of the moon, or have little rovers that are going along with their missions. And I think they understand that it's pretty cool to be able to see your spacecraft from afar, and in this case, have a flag that actually flaps on the moon, but with magnets instead of wind. An exoplanet has supersonic winds. Neptune has the fastest winds in the solar system. Astronomers have clocked its wind speeds at 2,100 kilometers per hour, but that is nothing compared to the winds that are blowing on WASP-127b. Astronomers recently did observations of this hot Jupiter that's orbiting around WASP-127, and they were able to calculate the velocity of the winds moving towards us compared to the ones that are moving away from us. And what they calculated is that the wind speeds are going 33,000 kilometers per hour. Now, the planet is kind of strange. It's 30% bigger than Jupiter, but it has one-fifth the mass of Jupiter. This is classified as a super puff world, which is kind of hilarious that this is a category of exoplanet. And so the planet is almost certainly tidally locked to the star, and it orbits every 4 hours. So it goes around very rapidly. And yet, for every orbit of the planet around the star, the winds go 6 times around the planet. And astronomers aren't entirely sure why you could get such high winds. Obviously, the planet is very close to its stars. There's a lot of energy that's being driven into it. It's rotating very quickly, but maybe that low density of the planet has something to do with these high wind speeds. And speaking of hot Jupiters, astronomers have been wondering how these things form. How do you get a planet that is the size of Jupiter, or maybe even more, that is orbiting extremely close to its star, maybe within just a few days or even a few hours? And astronomers assume that there's some kind of migration. The planet started farther out away from the star and then migrated inward over time. And the assumption is that if that happens, then that's going to cause mayhem to the rest of the planets that are in that system. As the planet moves past other orbits, it's going to eat planets, it's going to spiral them into the star, it's going to kick them out of the star system. But astronomers have found an exoplanetary system that contains 3 planets. One of them is a super Earth. One of them is like an icy planet, like a Neptune. And then the other one is a hot Jupiter. And yet they're stable and working together. And so the question is, how do you get this migration of this hot Jupiter to a place without kicking away those other planets that are in the system? And so one idea is, in fact, maybe this migration process is a lot more gentle than astronomers had originally thought. Or maybe the planet formed a lot closer to the star than anyone had expected, which is also kind of surprising. So it just shows that things aren't quite as dangerous as we thought out there among other star systems. Every week, we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what you thought was the best space news of the week. And the winner last week was the fact that Gaia is over. And, you know, it had some stiff competition. We saw the launch of New Glenn. We saw the 7th launch of Starship. And so I couldn't be prouder that you chose Gaia as the winning story. So pour one out for Gaia. Now, we post the new poll into our community tab here on our channel. But if you're just scrolling on YouTube, you should see the poll show up within about 24 hours of when we release this episode of Space Bites. So just take a second, vote for the story that you thought was the best this week, and we will count them up and we will celebrate next week. Of course, the best chance, subscribe to our channel, click on the notifications bell, and then just scroll and vote and just obey the algorithm. Predicting solar flares. Predicting space weather is very difficult. When we see some kind of activity on the surface of the sun, a bright flare, the kind of thing that is going to then cause damage to our satellite network, to our electrical grid, to our communication systems, we have often less than an hour of notice from when we see the flare to when the fastest, most highly energetic particles arrive at Earth. And that doesn't give us a lot of time to prepare. And so astronomers are trying to figure out a way to recognize when the sun is about to send off a very powerful solar flare. And there's this connection between the solar flares and these things called coronal loops. And they happen at around the same part of the atmosphere of the sun. But it doesn't seem like there's some kind of connection between the coronal loops and the flares, and no way to know when you're going to get that powerful solar flare. But now astronomers think they've found a sign, a tell, that the sun is about to release a powerful flare. They were observing these coronal loops with the Solar Dynamic Observatory, and they were looking in a wavelength of ultraviolet light. And they noticed that the coronal loops that happen at the same place where big, powerful flares happen, the coronal loops had variability in their ultraviolet emissions. And so it was sort of like a flickering warning that there's going to be a flare in that region. The stronger the upcoming flare, the brighter the warning. And so this should theoretically give us 2 to 6 hours of warning when we see a spot on the sun to when an actual powerful flare is released. And if so, like, this is a really exciting development and a better way to predict when we're going to have those scary solar flares. Why Mars has two different hemispheres. Mars has two very different hemispheres. You've got the southern hemisphere, which actually takes up about 2/3 of the planet. It has a much thicker crust. And in fact, regions in the southern hemisphere are 5 to 6 kilometers higher in elevation than regions in the northern hemisphere. But it was in the northern hemisphere where NASA's InSight probe landed, and it was listening to Mars quakes, listening for signals coming from various seismic events that happened inside Mars or meteorites striking Mars and things like that. And it had detected a whole bunch of them. And recently, planetary scientists identified that 6 of them, which had previously, they weren't sure where they had come from, they were able to realize that they were coming from the southern hemisphere on Mars and made it all the way through the planet. And so this is a region that is much less studied by Mars InSight. And so they have much less data about the Mars quakes that are coming from the southern hemisphere of Mars. And so there are two theories to why the two hemispheres of Mars are very different. One is that it came from inside, that you have convecting material inside Mars that sort of made its way to the surface and bulged out the southern hemisphere of Mars. The other possibility is that it came from space, that a large impact in the past smashed into Mars and caused a thinning in the crust in the northern hemisphere, and that's why you got this strange imbalance. And now, according to the Mars quake data from InSight, it looks like it's the internal convection method that is causing that bulging of the southern hemisphere. Curiosity finds ancient wave ripples on Mars. NASA's Curiosity rover has been on the surface of Mars for, well, like 13 years now, and its main job was to look for evidence that there was water, liquid water, on the surface of Mars for long periods of time. And it's found plenty of examples of evidence. It's found ancient lake beds where material has deposited. It's found what looks like ancient rivers and streams where water had been flowing for a long time. It's found minerals which can only be formed at the presence of water. But is that actually liquid water that was sitting on the surface of Mars, or was that water that was under like a thick shell of ice, like what we have in Antarctica? Well, now researchers have found what looks like ripples embedded into rock. And so think about a beach where you've got these small waves that are hitting the shore of the beach, and you get these ripples in the sand. And then some event covered up those ripples and they hardened and turned into rock. And now researchers have identified two places where you've got these sand ripples that have turned into rock. And they probably happened like 3.5 billion years ago, and yet they're still revealed to the surface of Mars. What this means is that in the ancient past on Mars, you had water that was exposed to the atmosphere on Mars, and that you had wind that was blowing this water and creating these ripples in the sand. And so this is one of the strongest lines of evidence that not only was there water on Mars for long periods of time, but it was actually exposed to the air, which is really cool. A 2.5 billion pixel image of Andromeda. The Hubble Space Telescope has been working on a project for 10 years, and NASA and ESA finally released the results of this work, which is the most insanely high resolution image of the Andromeda galaxy that Hubble has ever taken. The image is 2.5 billion pixels, and it was made up of dozens of separate observations over the course of 10 years. It took 1,000 orbits of Hubble making images to complete, and it contains 200 million individually identifiable stars. So this is a just ridiculous image of Andromeda. And, you know, we'll put a link so you can start the journey to download an image, but I'm not sure how big of a version of this you want to try and download to your local computer. Is this your new wallpaper for your 2.5 gigapixel television? Now, you're watching Space Bites, but I am currently writing my weekly Guide to Space email newsletter. This contains dozens of stories that we're not talking about here in Space Bites. For example, a fast radio burst that came from an old dead galaxy, tracing the big ideas that led to Webb, and how Ruben will find millions of supernovae. So I send out the newsletter every Friday. It's completely free. There's no ads in it. I write every word. So go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. Now I'm going to talk about some interviews that I'm going to be doing, but first I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew M. Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Robach, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So it is NIAC season again, and that is that the 2025 NASA Advanced Innovative Concept Awards have been announced, and there are 15 Phase One awardees that have been announced, and I have already interviewed some of them. I've reached out to all of them, and hopefully I will be able to schedule that. In addition, we've got a ton of really interesting interviews that are coming out. I'm now, in some cases, conducting 2 interviews a day, so it's going to be a very busy interview season coming up over the next couple of months. But we have a playlist that is just for NIAC conversations, and so if you want to check that out, it's got all of the past years of the NIAC awardees. And then as we conduct these new interviews, we will add them to that playlist and we'll give you this bold science fiction space exploration future that we've all been hoping for. All right, we'll see you next week.